Wedded Life by Mrs. C. H. Spurgeon. Matrimony came from paradise and leads to it. I never was half so happy before I was a married man as I am now. When you are married, your bliss begins. Let the husband love his wife as he loves himself, and a little better, for she is his better half. He should feel, if there only one good wife in the whole world, I've got her. John Plowman has long thought just that of his own wife, and after 35 years he is more sure of it than ever. There is not a better woman on the surface of the globe than his own, very own, beloved, John Plowman. Again, the responsible task lies before me of interweaving my own dearest personal memories of my beloved's autobiography, that the picture of his life's history may glow with the fair colors and present some of the finishing touches which are needed to render it as complete as possible. Alas, that his dear hand is powerless to furnish them. Every line I write fills me with regret that I cannot better set forth the remembrance of his worth and goodness. Someone wrote to me lately saying that it was impossible for a man's nearest friends to give a true and impartial idea of him. They lived in too close proximity to him. Their vision was interrupted by their admiration. They could not see many things that others, looking on with a remoter and broader point of vantage, could distinctly discern. This seems to me a great mistake, except indeed in cases where distance leads enchantment to the view. For who could so reasonably be supposed to understand and recognize the inner qualities and disposition of an individual's character as the one who lived in constant and familiar intercourse with him, and to whom his heart was as a clear, calm lake, reflecting heaven's own light and beauty? Those who knew my husband best can testify that intimate knowledge of his character and close companionship with him did but more clearly reveal how very near, by God's grace, he had come in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God unto a perfect man, unto the measure of his stature of the fullness of Christ. Not in his own estimation, be it well understood, he never spoke of himself as having apprehended. He was always a poor sinner and nothing at all. So preeminently and gloriously was Jesus Christ his all in all, that his gracious, gentle, lovely life testified daily to the indwelling of the Holy Spirit in his heart and the exceeding power of God, which kept him through faith and enabled him to walk worthy of the vocation wherewith he was called. Robert Murray McChinney used to pray, O God, make me as holy as a pardoned sinner can be made, and to judge by my husband's life, a similar petition must have been constantly in his heart, if not on his lips. Our brief wedding trip was spent in Paris, and as I had made many previous visits to the fair city, besides spending some months in the Christian household of Pastor Audebez in order to acquire the language, I felt quite at home there and had the intense gratification of introducing my husband to all the places and sights which were worthy of arousing his interest and admiration. We had a cozy suite of rooms, by special favor, in the ENTRESOL of the Hotel MEURICE, and every day we explored some fresh MUSEE, or church, or picture gallery, or drove to some place of historic fame, all the charms of Paris seeming 10 times more charming in my eyes than they had ever been before, because of those other loving eyes which now looked upon them with me. The city was then in the days of her luxury and prosperity. No communist fires had scorched or blackened her streets. No turbulent mobs had despoiled her temples and palaces and laid her glories in the dust. She was triumphant and radiant, and in the pride of her heart was saying, I set a queen. and shall see no sorrow. Alas, there were days of calamity and tribulation in store for her, when war and bloodshed and fire and famine raged her beauty and laid waste her choice habitations. But no forecast of such terrible visitations troubled our hearts. The halo of the present illuminated all the future. We went to Versailles, to the Louvre, the Madeleine, the Jardins, and many other places. In fact, to every place we could find time for, where Christian people might go and yet bring away with them a clear conscience. A peep at the Bordeaux interested us very much. What a scene of strife it was. What a deafening noise the men made. My husband quaintly depicted the excitement in a few words. The pot boiled more and more furiously at the hour of three approached, and then the brokers, like the foam of the top, ran over and all the black contents, followed by degrees. Anyone acquainted with the place and its customs will recognize the accuracy and humor of this graphic description. Spelled B-O-U-R-S-E. Naturally, the interiors of the churches attracted much of our attention. We always found something to admire, though alas, there was also much to deplore. A peep at the Bourse, B-O-U-R-S-E, interested us very much. What a scene of strife it was. What a deafening noise the men made. My husband quaintly displicted the excitement in a few words. The pot boiled more and more feverishly as the hour of three approached. And then the brokers, like the foam on the top, ran over and all the black contents, followed by degrees. Anyone acquainted with the place and its customs will recognize the accuracy and the humor of this graphic description. Naturally, the interiors of the churches attracted much of our attention. We always found something to admire, though alas, there was also much to deplore. When we visited the Cathedral of Notre Dame, I was able to interest my companion by telling him that I had seen it in full gala dress on the occasion of the marriage of Emperor Napoleon III to his charming Empress Eugenie, and how glittering and gorgeous it then looked, with its abundant draperies of imperial purple velvet embroidered all over with golden bees. All the wealth and riches of the great sanctuary was then pressed into service, and the result was magnificent. Without such adornment, the church has a simple and solemn grandeur of its own, very smoothing to the mind, and at the time of which I am writing, its sanctity was enhanced in the opinion of its Roman Catholic worshippers by its possession of such sacred relics as part of the true cross and the crown of thorns. These were shown to visitors on payment of an extra fee, as was also an amazing number of splendid vestments encrusted with gold and jewels and worth a prince's ransom. I believe that at the time of the commune, much of the treasure was carried away or ruthlessly destroyed. The beauty of the Saintine Chapel specially delighted us, and we went there more than once. It was a little heaven of stained glass, was my beloved's verdict. And truly its loveliness looked almost celestial as we stood enwrapped in its radiance, the light of the sinking sun glorifying its matchless windows into a very dream of dazzling grace and harmony of color. Then there were St. Roth, St. Sulpice, and a host of other churches, not forgetting St. Etienne-du-Mont, a grand edifice containing the sumptuous shrine of Ste. Period, Genevieve, in its way a perfect gem, nor St. Germain l-auxerrois, with its ancient rose windows and its pathetic memories of the betrayed Huguenots. The Pantheon, too, once a temple, now a church, received a share of our interested attention. So far as I can remember, the building itself was almost empty, except for some statues ranged around it, but we descript it to the crypt, which contains the tombs of Voltaire and other notable and or notorious men. And we listened with something like fear to the thunderous echo which lurks there and attracts visitors to its subterranean vaults. It is very loud and terrible, like a cannon fired off, and it gives one quite an uncanny feeling to hear such a deafening roar down in the bowels of the earth. After this experience, we were very glad to get into fresh air again. Of course, we went to St. Cloud, now alas in ruins. There is, or was, a lonely, lovely walk through the park to the summit of the eminence crowned of the lantern of Diogenes. From there, the view was glorious. The Seine flowed far below. The suburb of the city lay beyond. Mount Valerien on the right, Paris straight before one's eyes, with the gilded dome of the Invalids shining in the clear air, Saint Sulpice and the Pantheon, and countless spirals and towers forming landmarks in a great sea of houses and streets, the twin heights of Montmartre and Perlaise in the background. All these grouped together and viewed from the hill formed an indescribably charming picture. I tried to be a good cicerone, and I think I fairly succeeded, for my companion was greatly delighted, and in after years, in his frequent visits to the French capital, with friends and fellow voyagers, he took upon himself the role of conductor, with the happiest and most satisfactory results. He was never at a loss where to go or how to spend the time in the most pleasant and profitable manner. A little note written from Paris 20 years after our wedding trip contains the following sentences. My heart flies to you as I remember my first visit to this city under your dear guidance. I love you now as then, only multiplied many times. Ah, tender grace of a day that is dead. Thy joy is not lessened by distance, nor lost by separation. Rather, it is stored both in heaven and in my heart's deepest chambers, and some day, when that casket is broken, it will come back to me, not here, but in that happy land where the days die not, where the touch of a vanquished hand shall be felt again, and the sound of a voice that is still shall again make music in my ravished ears. 'Twas a brief, bright season, this wedding trip of ours, lasting about 10 days, for my husband could not leave his sacred work for a longer time, and we were both eager to return that we might discover the delights of having a home of our own and enjoy the new sensation of feeling ourselves master and mistress of all we surveyed. What a pure, unsullied joy was that homecoming. How we thanked and praised the Lord for his exceeding goodness to us in bringing us there, and how earnestly and tenderly my husband prayed that God's blessing might rest upon us then and evermore. How we admired everything in the house and thought there never was quite such a delightful home before will be best understood by those who have lived in Loveland and are well acquainted with the happiness of setting up housekeeping there. On the table in the little sitting room lay a small parcel, which, when open, proved to be a dainty card case as a wedding present from Mr. W. Poole Balfour, accompanied by the following lines, which I have transcribed and recorded here since they were truly our first welcome home, and in a sense prophetic of our future lives. A nuptial wish. Dear friends, I scarce know what to say on this important nuptial day. I wish you joy, and while you live, such gifts that only God can give. Whether life be short or long, dark with grief or bright with song, whether sorrowful or glad, whether prosperous or sad, oh, that you, through Christ, may be heirs of immortality, heirs of righteousness and peace, heirs of life that never shall cease, heirs of glories yet to come, heirs of the eternal home, in the valley, on the height, in the darkness, and in the light, still possessed of living grace, pressing on with eager pace, ever keeping Christ in view, meek and humble, just and true. helpers of each other's faith, one in Him in life and death. By His Spirit taught and led, by His grace and mercy fed, blessed and guarded by His love, till with Him you meet above. I think the circumstances under which my beloved and Mr. Belfern met are also worthy of a passing notice. One Saturday, the time for sermon preparation had arrived, and the dear preacher had shut himself up in his study when a ministerial visitor was announced. He would not give his name, but said, "Tell Mr. Spurgeon that a servant of the Lord wishes to see him." To this, my husband replied, "Tell the gentleman that I am so busy with his master that I cannot attend to the servant." Then word was sent that W. Poole Belford was the visitor, and no sooner did Mr. Spurgeon hear the name than he ran out to him, clasped his hand in both his own, and exclaimed, "W. Poole Belford, the man who wrote Glimpses of Jesus, come in, thou blessed of the Lord." Describing that interview long afterwards, Mr. Belford said, "I learned then that the secret of Mr. Spurgeon's success was that he was cradled in the Holy Ghost. It was a very remarkable expression, which I do not remember to have met with anywhere else, but it was as true as it was striking. So many memories cling about our first home, and so many notable events of early married life transpired within its walls, that I must ask my readers kindly to refer to the view given in Volume 1, page 5, that they may the more readily understand the description which follows. On the ground floor, the single window, now almost hidden by a tree, planted since the days of which I write, marks the little front parlor or living room, in old-fashioned parlance, where the greater part of their home life was spent. Above this, and boasting two windows, was a very fair-sized room, the best in the house, and therefore devoted to the best of uses. The master study and the two windows immediately over this belonged to a bedchamber of the same size, where afterwards our twin boys first saw the light of day. It may not be out of place to say here that, in all the houses we have lived in, four in all, we never encumbered ourselves with what a modern writer calls the drawback of a drawing room, perhaps for the good reason that we were such homely busy people that we had no need of so useless a place, but more especially, I think, because the best room was always felt to belong, by right, to the one who labored much in the Lord. Never have I regretted this early decision. It is a wise arrangement for a minister's house, if not for any other. When we first came to Westwood, where there is a fine room for society purposes, there was much merry discussion as to how it should be furnished. Already the large billiard room was converted into a study and filled with books from the floor to the arch of the ceiling. But more space was needed for my husband's precious volumes, and his heart was set on seeing the grand room turned into an equally grand library. I proposed with great glee that we should go on to the Bofian's Bower plan. She keeps up her part of the room in her way. I keeps up my part of the room in mine. And with shouts of laughter, we would amuse ourselves by imagining the big room filled up for half its length as my lady's parlor, the other half being devoted to literary pursuits, and so arranged that Silas Wegg could come and drop into poetry whenever it so pleased him. In time, the question settled itself. It was quite 12 months before the huge bookshelves, which were to line the room, were completed and put in place, and then it looked like a fine library, that none could doubt its right or claim to this honorable appellation. But this is a digression. We began housekeeping on a very modest scale, and even then had to practice rigid economics in all things, for my dear husband earnestly longed to help young men to preach the gospel, and from our slender resources we had to contribute somewhat largely to the support and education of Mr. T.W. Medhurst, who was the first to receive training for the work. From so small a beginning sprang the present pastor's college, with its splendid record of service, both done and doing, of which fuller account will be given in future chapters. I rejoice to remember how I shared my beloved's joy when he founded the institution, and that, together, we planned and pinched in order to carry out the purpose of his loving heart. It gave me quite a motherly interest in the college and our own men. The chief difficulty with regard to money matters in those days was to make both ends meet. We never had enough left over to tie a bow on ends. But I can see now that this was God's way of preparing us to sympathize with and help poor pastors in the years which were to come. One of these good men, when recounting to me the griefs of his poverty, once said, "You can scarcely understand, for you have never been in the same position." But my thoughts flew back to this early time, and I could truly say, I may not have been in such depths of need as seems now likely to swallow you up, but I well remember when we lived on the do-without system, and only God's providence was our inheritance, and when he often stretched forth his hand and wrought signal deliverances for us, when our means were sorely straitened, and the coffers of both college and household were well nigh empty. I recall a special time of need, supplied by great and unexpected mercy. Some demand came in for payment. I think it must have been a tax or rate, for I never had bills owing to tradesmen, and we had nothing wherewith to meet it. What a distressing condition of excitement seized us. "Wifey," said my beloved, "what can we do? I must give up hiring the horse and walk to New Park Street every time I preach." "Impossible," I replied. "With so many services, you simply could not do it." Long and anxiously we pondered over ways and means and laid our burden before the Lord, entreating him to come to our aid. And, of course, he heard and answered, for he is a faithful God. That night or the next day, I am not sure which, a letter was received containing £20 for our own use, and we never knew who sent it, save that it came in answer to prayer. This was our first united and personal home experience of special necessity, provided for by our Heavenly Father, and our hearts felt a very solemn awe and gladness as we realized that he knew what things we have need of before we asked him. As the years rolled by, such eventful passages in our history were graciously multiplied and even excelled. But perhaps this first blessed deliverancy was the foundation stone of my husband's strong and mighty faith, for I do not remember ever afterwards seeing him painfully anxious concerning supplies for any of his great works. He depended wholly on the Lord, his trust was perfect, and he lacked nothing. End of chapter 48, having been read by Peter John Parisi, also known as Brian Dean. None of my audios are copyrighted. Please feel free to make as many copies as you desire to the glory of God.